News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Here's to Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, here's to your health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, Christy will be talking with Dr. John Dittmer about human rights and social justice in healthcare, the third in a series on medicine and ethics, as Dr. Dittmer was just in town and Christy had an opportunity to interview him. But first, Christy, we have some really interesting research that matters about some things that are maybe surprising to some people.
Yeah, the first one is about diabetes, and it's about whether or not we can improve diabetes outcomes by adding a patient intervention as well as involving the physician.
You know, increasingly, we're working on trying to improve chronic diseases like diabetes, like high blood pressure, and a lot of that focuses on really doing lots of things simultaneously in the patient encounter. And this is one of those examples where they tried to get us, Christy, you and I, to do a better job with our patients by doing what?
Well, they were looking to see if they could engage the doctor to take care of patients, but also engage the patient by sending out a letter to the patients to say, these are the things that are most important for you to remind your doctor to address at your upcoming visit.
Yeah, and this was actually an article that was in the Israel Medical Association Journal, and they had 417 patients with type 2 diabetes, and half of them essentially got this physician-only intervention where, you know, we would do what we would normally doing, and the other half got this letter and this combined physician plus patient intervention.
So what they did was just as we described, and then they followed it at 1 year to see if there were any changes in the targets for diabetes in the people who just received physician only versus physician plus the letter to activate the patient.
And interestingly enough, most of the outcomes were actually pretty similar, but not really significantly different in terms of the hemoglobin A1C. That's that 3-month average of blood sugar, the LDL or the low density lipoprotein, the bad cholesterol, and the systolic blood pressure control. If you looked at them individually, they were, again, not significantly different.
But they did find that significantly more patients in the combined interventions, the one who got that letter, 39% of those compared with the physician-only intervention, 24% of those met all three targets, being that A1C below a certain level, that bad cholesterol below a certain level, and the blood pressure below a certain level. So there were improvements in the group that had that additional letter to the patient.
Yeah, one of the things that it makes me a little concerned, Christy, is, you know, increasingly there's so much that physicians are being called upon to do and remember, and you would think that this is automatically a good thing, a letter to our listeners to then or to us, and then we bring in to our doctors. But I also think this brings up issues because it may come at a cost. If we start talking about things that someone's directing us to talk to, we might forget about talking about things that at some cases could even be more important in that particular encounter. And so sometimes I worry about that there may be some cost here, particularly because the benefits individually, even though you're right, combined were there, individually were not so great. And so sometimes I worry about unintended consequences.
Well, I would say that we do know that reminding doctors to do what we're supposed to do is effective. And so we can do that in a number of ways. This way was a letter to the patient, but by having prompts and reminders in our health records to address certain issues as they relate to diabetes, there is good evidence to say that we do better if people remind us. So, I mean, this is one more piece of it, and I do think we have to think of it more, think it through, but I think it's a positive step.
Well, think about thinking it through. This is next a research article. Really, it actually goes from about as far away as we can go. It goes from the Western medicine to the Eastern medicine, and looking at what do we know about traditional Chinese medicine, but yet treating a common condition in Western medicine, chronic hepatitis B, and what have we learned from China?
Yeah, so this is really good for us to think about what do we know about traditional Chinese medicine, which, you know, a lot of Western doctors might just discount as being, you know, not proven or different than the way we think. What do we know about randomized control trials that compare either traditional Chinese medicine alone or in combination with some of the things we do in Western medicine, like interferon or certain medicine called lamivudine?
Yeah, and what they looked at is they compared all the research that was in the Chinese literature, looking at these comparisons, and then try to say how good these studies were and then what were the outcomes. And while there were significant quality problems in these studies in terms of maybe not being as good as we would like, interestingly enough, the outcomes looked to be equal or better than some of the medicines that are traditionally used in this country. And this was actually published in Hepatology, which is the journal, major journal for liver disease.
Sure. I mean, I think it's great, although the method quality was poor, so you can't draw strong conclusions. But at least that they had this traditional Chinese medicine looked promising, looked as good as what we're doing, and certainly opens it. I think this should open up our minds a little bit to say that maybe the way other people do it has some validity, and we should.
And at the very least, a randomized controlled trial of a very good quality should be done, because there are potential side effects, and I don't think I don't certainly know enough about that, and I don't really know how I'd counsel people to say, take a traditional Chinese medicine.
Sure.
I don't think I could certainly do that, but more research is needed.
Sure. Well, now, as we're talking about alternative medicine, this is a study on complementary and alternative medicine use in epistaxis or...
Nosebleed.
Thank you. I'm like, come on, bleeding from the nose. Nosebleeds. And just highlighting that it's worth us taking a history of what people are taking.
Yeah, you know, this was just really essentially a kind of a case report in the European Journal of Emergency Medicine, Christy. But it talked about, you know, a patient who had difficult to control bleeding of the nose, and they really didn't see significant risk factors until someone, I think very smartly, said, well, are you taking any over-the-counter medications, non-prescription medications, herbal medications, anything that a doctor hasn't told you to take but that you're taking as a supplement? What did they find?
Well, and in this particular case, this young man had been taking a combination of aspirin, garlic tablets, and milk thistle. And garlic increases bleeding time, and all of them can alter, and milk thistle alters the function of the liver enzymes, which help promote your ability to clot when you have a bleed.
Yeah, and you know, there are certain other things that can be more likely to make bleeding possible as we're talking about bleeding. Things like chondroitin and glucosamine, things like vitamin E.
Or high doses of fish oil.
Yeah, we were talking about that on a recent show. So lots of things that could contribute to this worth thinking about. And not all herbal or supplements are created equal.
Right. And I think this really highlights that patients, you need to tell your healthcare providers everything that you're taking, and that doctors need to do a better job of asking and really taking that really key part of the patient's history.
Yep. Well, our very last research that matters is an article about coffee and heart arrhythmias from a presentation, actually, the American Heart Association's annual conference on heart disease.
Well, of course, I love this because I'm a big coffee drinker. This is a study about 130,000 men and women, adults, and they were followed over time and sort of separated out by how much coffee they drank and their risk of hospitalization for heart arrhythmias or heart rhythm problems.
Yeah, and most of these heart rhythm problems, the most frequent one is atrial fibrillation. And the concern here is that, you know, if you have atrial fibrillation or if you're maybe you feel like you're at some risk, or is it okay, is it safe to drink coffee, because are you going to have higher rates of this atrial fibrillation develop? And some people would, and I think I would have worried a little bit about this because, you know, the caffeine and stimulating the cardiovascular system. But it's not what they found.
No, they found the group of people who drank 4 or more cups of coffee per day had an 18% lower risk of hospitalization for arrhythmia. So the opposite of what common sense might tell you.
Yeah, and those who drank 1 to 3 cups a day had a 7% reduction in risk. So this doesn't mean that it's safe that you should go out and drink lots of coffee to lower your risk. But what it does probably mean is that there probably isn't excess risk there. And so you don't have to limit your coffee consumption if indeed you were worried about a heart arrhythmia.
So we've had a chance to talk a little bit about complementary and alternative medicines and nosebleeds.
And possible effects of traditional Chinese medicine on chronic hepatitis B.
About activating both patients and doctors to improve the care of diabetes.
And then finally, coffee and its possibly lack of effect on arrhythmias.
So that concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, I'll be talking with Dr. John Dittmer more about human rights and social justice in healthcare. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Here's to Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health. Today on Conversations, I'm going to talk with Dr. John Dittmer about human rights and social justice in healthcare. This is the third topic that Adam and I are doing on medical ethics, and I'd like to welcome Dr. John Dittmer. Dr. Dittmer is a professor emeritus of history at DePaul University in Indiana, as well as an award-winning author and a nationally recognized authority on the civil rights movement. Today, we're going to be discussing Dr. Dittmer's latest book, The Good Doctors, The Medical Committee for Human Rights and the Struggle for Social Justice in Healthcare. We're so glad to have you with us today.
Delighted to be here.
You know, one of the things that Adam and I love to start out with is to hear your story, to hear what is it that made you become so passionate about this topic. You refer in your book as this book being an act of atonement for missing out on a chapter of the civil rights movement. I wonder if you might share your story and how you see this book.
Well, we had lived in Mississippi in the late 60s and 1970s. And I had written a book a decade or so ago called Local People about the civil rights movement in Mississippi. And the group that I had missed was the Medical Committee for Human Rights, which was active from 64 to 66. And our family physician, Dr. Robert Smith, who is one of the major characters of my book, kept telling me that I needed to find out more about this organization. The more I found out, the more fascinated I became, and I realized that here was a really important group that practically nobody knew anything about.
Well, I certainly didn't know very much about it before reading your book, so I'm excited for our listeners to learn a bit more. Talk to us about the Medical Committee for Human Rights and how it was formed and its major role.
Well, the MCHR was formed. It came out of the civil rights movement. During the spring of 1964, civil rights activists in Mississippi decided to invite 1,000 volunteers, most of them northern white college students, down to the state to help them in a variety of tasks. And the local black doctors, particularly Bob Smith, were alarmed. There were very few black doctors in the state. You couldn't expect the white doctors to be very kind to people who were out to destroy their way of life. So Smith invited his friends from mainly from New York to come to Mississippi for the summer and to give health care to civil rights workers. After a series of meetings, the Medical Committee for Human Rights was formed, and upwards of 100 people came down for the summer to do just that.
And what were the major roles of this group as it developed?
Well, once they got to Mississippi, they realized that the civil rights workers were young and they were pretty healthy. But what they did find were hundreds of thousands of African Americans who were living in poverty, who had practically no access to health care. You must remember that this was a time before Medicare and Medicaid. It was very difficult for anybody to get on welfare. Many of these people had never even seen a physician, let alone be admitted to a hospital.
And so this was sort of an exposing of the inequalities of health care for these people who were impoverished?
Yes, it was. And for the doctors, it was quite a shock. They had not expected to see these kinds of conditions in the United States.
And so in your book, you talk a little bit about a major accomplishment being a response to that poverty, a response to that real need for health care and the birth of community health centers. How did that happen?
Well, this is one, I think, one of the most important achievements of the medical committee. It, again, came out of Mississippi. There was a small health clinic in a town called Milestone, and they wanted to expand that. But that was a privately funded clinic, and they knew they couldn't do that going after private money all the time. So H. Jack Geiger and John Hatch and Count Gibson local physicians, not local physicians, physicians who came to Mississippi, got the idea that they would do a comprehensive community health center. It had never been done in this country before, and they got the OEO to fund it.
Wow. So what did that look like?
Well, the difference between the health clinics that you normally found in the South and the North, you would go in for shots and pills. What the comprehensive community health center dealt with was what would later be called the social determinants of health. That is the environment. In Mississippi, where the first center was located in Mound Bayou in the Mississippi Delta, one of the poorest counties in the nation, why they found people living in shacks with no windows, no screens, unsanitary privies, in short, all the kinds of things that made you sick. So they addressed those problems as well as the problems of the immediate illness that people had.
So it's a real blending of the direct doctor-patient care with public health measures.
Yes, it was. And it's Jack Geiger, who was the head of the center, had degrees both in medicine and in public health. He brought that with him, but mainly they learned from the local people what their problems were. They sort of put that together on the fly, and the result became a model for the rest of the country.
Wow, we're certainly glad that is. That community health centers mm-hmm. have such an important presence in our society today. The other question I wanted to get to is the tension between this group, the Medical Committee for Human Rights, and the American Medical Association, and some of the tension about racial differences in doctors.
Yeah, the AMA was an initial target of the Medical Committee because within their southern affiliates, many of them did not permit black physicians to enter. They were whites-only organizations. Now, this was more than a social slight, because if you didn't belong to the local medical association, why, you didn't have hospital privileges. So even in those areas where blacks were admitted to segregated wings of the hospitals, very often their doctors couldn't follow them. They began protesting against the AMA in 1963, and the AMA's response was always, well, we really don't approve of what our southern affiliates do, but we are powerless to do anything about it. It was not until 1968 that the AMA changed its policy.
Wow, and that was out of protest from this group?
It was partly in terms of protest, partly because of the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, Title VI of which stated that you could not get federal funds if you discriminated by race.
Ah.
By that time, Medicare and Medicaid had kicked in, and the southern hospitals had no choice if they wanted federal money, which they desperately needed. So the point was practically moot by then. But I should point out that it was only 2 years ago that the AMA formally apologized to the black doctors for keeping them out for so long.
Wow, it's hard to fathom that in today's society that it was that extreme. I'm talking with Dr. John Dittmer about human rights and social justice in healthcare, and you know, Dr. Dittmer, the other thing I was hoping to talk about is about the radical notion at that time that this idealism for equality in healthcare. Whether that was a radical idea or whether that became radicalized, it was dangerous for some of the people involved. And you write about that in your book, some as local as Greensboro to here in Chapel Hill. Can you speak to that, idealism being dangerous?
Well, yes. I mean, this was in the latter phase of the medical committee in the late 1970s. And there were a group of physicians in and around the Chapel Hill, Greensboro, Duke area, Durham area, who had started a medical committee for human rights chapter here and later became extremely radicalized. They developed a Maoist philosophy, and that was the group that was that held the Death to the Klan rally in November of 1979. And five of these people, including two physicians, were murdered by the police in that shootout that day.
Gosh, that's really mm-hmm. profound. And you write about that in the book mm-hmm. and give some names. And it sounds like As that developed, is it clear that was it the ideas that were so radical to the rest of mainstream, or was it the group itself that became got different leadership and on a different direction?
In the latter phase of the medical committee, it was sort of part of the new left. And by the mid-1970s, it was the last national organization of the new left standing. So it was ripe pickings for various Communist Party groups to try to infiltrate it and take it over, which, in fact, they did in the latter stages of that movement. So what happened in Greensboro was sort of one of the final events of this kind of medical radicalism of the 1970s.
Okay. Well, we do need to take a short break, but when we return, I'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. John Dittmer, about human rights and social justice in healthcare. We'll be right back with UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health. Here's to Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health. I'm Dr. Christy Page. I've been talking with Dr. John Dittmer about social justice in healthcare, and particularly about his book entitled The Good Doctors. And Dr. Dittmer, we were talking a bit about the Medical Committee for Human Rights and about your book and about this, a little bit about the radical idea that medical care is a right for all. Speak to that. Is that really a radical idea?
Well, it was then, and I think among some people, obviously with a health care debate going on, it still is now. The slogan of the medical committee was health care is a human right, and that has been taken up by people these days. But that came in response to the president of the American Medical Association making the statement in 67 or 68 that some people believe that health care is a right instead of a privilege, which it is. So the medical committee took out a full-page ad in the New York Times attacking the AMA and saying that health care is a right and calling for what would be called single-payer health insurance today.
And so what can we learn from the struggles that this group and that we as a nation had during the civil rights movement that can guide us in this current health care debate, where it does seem like some people still think this notion that everyone should get adequate health care is such a radical idea?
What has struck me with my research, and I concentrated on the health care debate during the Nixon years, and that's not talked about much. But during the end of Richard Nixon's first term, practically everybody thought there would be national health insurance. Nixon was even favoring some kind of a policy because they were really worried about the rising costs of Medicare, which, of course, seemed trivial in comparison with today. But what happened is that the same forces united and used divide and conquer. The idea that this would be socialized medicine and that you would not be able to choose your own doctor. All of these same arguments that were used then later during the Clinton years are being rolled out today. And what's really surprising and extremely discouraging is that they seem to have taken hold again.
And so thinking about sort of the association with this group with communism and then the way people insert that fear into today's debate of socialistic medicine, and how do we articulate what we're talking about for healthcare being a right versus a privilege?
Well, I've heard, and I think this is a good analogy, you know, is police protection a right or a privilege? Is your fire department? Is education? We all accept those as part of being citizens and part of living in a progressive country. It seems to me unconscionable that you would exclude health care, which is essential to enjoying all of these things and more, from that category. But there are people who have good health care, and they think that as long as that continues, why, they don't have to be terribly concerned about those who don't.
I want to talk a bit about the role of doctors in social justice and healthcare. So one of the, well, the quotes from the book that was that the leaders of this medical community for human, medical committee for human rights, was that being a doctor is not enough. Just being a doctor and going out and caring for everyone, potentially including the poor, but being a doctor and doing that one-on-one care is not enough. What does that mean to you?
Well, I think what it meant certainly to them is that these doctors were activists, but many of them became activists because they got their training in inner-city hospitals, and they saw the quality of life that mostly black and minority people who were their patients had, and they knew that something was wrong with the system. You had to change the system. And simply by saying you were going to do everything you could to do a good job simply wasn't enough. You had to be political, and these doctors sort of embraced that once they realized it.
And what about today? So these doctors who are and nurses who were involved in this medical committee so many years ago, some of them are still alive today?
Yes, they are. They're in their late 70s and 80s, and they're still very active. For example, one of the leaders of the medical committee in the 60s and 70s is Dr. Quentin Young of Chicago, who is the co-founder of Physicians for a National Health Program, an organization of nearly 20,000 physicians supporting single payer. And I found going across the country and talking to people that wherever they are still campaigning for the same kinds of things that they were back then, and that is quality health care for everyone.
And so is there a modern-day equivalent to the medical community for human rights, or what are the other spinoff organizations?
Well, you have the organization I mentioned, Physicians mm-hmm. for Social Responsibility. There are Doctors Without Borders. There are a number of them. But getting back to your question about political, MCHR was a political organization. It was national. It could rally people around a single issue. If necessary, it could take out full pages in the New York Times. It had people on Capitol Hill listening to them. So this is the kind of thing you can't go back and say we're going to recreate this. But the organization is needed now, I think, even though it went out of existence in the early 1980s.
And so what would you recommend? I mean, I know you're a historian, but it is the history that reveals what is needed today. How would you articulate what we need now to organize those various spinoff organizations or like-minded thinkers to help us really try to bridge the gap of racial disparity and the inequalities that still exist in our medical health care today?
Well, this is what is so discouraging, I think, because in a way you had that more than ever before. There are single-payer organizations all over the country. People who were active in the Obama campaign have been keeping active now and putting pressure on, and yet it really hasn't seemed to work. I mean, the verdict isn't in. I think we can be reasonably hopeful that some kind of bill will be passed. But I think that what has to be done is not just every time it comes up as a political issue, but there has to be organizing on the local level, raising political consciousness, that this is not just a problem for people who don't have health care. It's a problem for all of us as citizens.
Wow. Well, I hope that as you're going and promoting your book, that these messages about a unified voice and really just raising the issue of healthcare being an important right, that people should be able to receive healthcare. I think exposing that history hopefully will help us unify that voice for the future.
Well, thank you. I agree.
We've been talking with Dr. John Dittmer about social justice and healthcare. And, you know, I want to make sure we have time to talk about a little bit about the book and how people might find your book called The Good Doctors.
Yeah, it is available now in hardback. It will be coming out in paperback a couple of months. The publisher is Bloomsbury Press. I know that a number of local bookstores have it. The regulator in Raleigh, I know, is going to be having copies at a signing I'm doing tomorrow at Duke. But you can also always get it on Amazon.com.
Great. So people could just go and Google The Good Doctors?
Yes. It's It's easy to do.
That's great. Well, we hope people who are intrigued by this conversation will go and pick up your book. It's really fascinating to think how far we've come, but also how far we really need to go and learning from that history for the future. So thank you so much, Dr. Dittmer, for being with us.
I really enjoyed being here.
I've been talking with historian and author Dr. John Dittmer. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health on WCHL. Stay with us.
Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Here's to Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health. And I was really so glad to hear that interview, Christy, that you were able to do with Dr. Dittmer. Very, very interesting.
Thanks. I really enjoyed talking with him.
Well, for the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions, experiences, and particularly your attitudes about medical care.
We want you to write us and share your attitudes, share your experiences, and give us your questions, and we'll try to address these on an upcoming show. We want you to send your comments and questions to yourhealth@unc.edu, and we'll have our producer, Julie Steiner, read us some of the questions we have today. What's our first house call, Julie?
Our first listener writes, my 62-year-old mother has had very painful osteoarthritis in both knees for many years. So far, I don't seem to be having any problems, but I'm wondering if osteoarthritis can be prevented.
Great question.
A good question, and it's actually a more complex question than it maybe appears on the situation, you know, because what do we mean by prevented? Can you prevent it from ever coming on? Can you prevent it in you?
Can you put it off to happening till later in life, maybe?
Yeah, and the answers are maybe, 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 maybe. There's lots of issues here. Starting fact that, you know, you're probably, my guess is you're in your 30s here, given the age of your mother. And so the likelihood of you getting that type of arthritis, assuming that it's not due to things like rheumatoid arthritis or other types of systemic diseases, isn't going to happen to you likely for another 20 or 30 years, assuming you're not overweight.
And there is a tendency to inherit these or to have maybe you're at higher risk because your mother had osteoarthritis. But the most important thing for you to do to try to reduce your risk, as you say, Adam, is to try to keep a healthy weight, to maintain an optimal weight so that your joints aren't trying to carry around all that extra weight over time.
You know, and I guess if you did have a genetic tendency even, one of the things you would probably want to avoid is long-distance running, the constant pounding on the knees, which does eventually over time begin to erode cartilage in many folks. So again, finding some non-pounding exercises like bicycling or swimming that could protect your cartilage.
Mm-hmm. Julie, what do we have next?
My mom is in her 70s. She is relatively healthy and very active. Recently, I discovered that she has high blood pressure. Her blood pressure runs between 140 and 150 on the top number. She told me that her doctor has been watching it, but that he doesn't think she needs to start medicine due to her age. What do you think about that? My doctor makes a big deal about getting the top number under 140. Is that not the case for the elderly?
This is a great question, and one that I think doctors have changed their thinking about over time.
I'm going to say a maybe. So let's hear what you have to say, Christy, because I'm not sure we'll totally agree on this one. But let's hear.
So I do think that that doctors are more cautious with the elderly, that you don't want to over-treat blood pressure or to put people on medications that might increase their risk to fall, and you want to think about the big picture of this person's life. However, we used to think, oh, let's just watch it, we'll just let it go as people are older. But in fact, there's growing evidence to say that people, as they get older, may benefit from lowering the blood pressure even more, because when you're thinking about risk for stroke and for heart disease and heart attack, making a difference in that blood pressure may have a more timely effect in that person's life. So if she's spry and healthy and in her 70s, it sounds like she's got some life to live. And in that setting, I do think that getting the blood pressure to a more reasonable level is helpful.
Yeah, and I think I'd agree with that fully, Christy. The part that's always the interesting part here is what's the conversation between the doctor and the patient here? Because there's always this question of the relative benefit that one gets in research from following you know, thousands of patients, and then how the absolute benefit that you will get. And that's always a much smaller benefit. And so one of these things here is the values here in the patient. So you're absolutely right, and I would agree with you. And I would probably counsel that, you know, that I would recommend the medication. But then if I get pushback from the patient, I would say, well, let's talk about how likely you are to benefit. What are the risks here? And because I don't want to cause you to feel worse, but yet most doctors would say you should be treated.
Sure. And that's also a situation where if your mom is not comfortable with the conversation, or if you are not comfortable, you could talk with your mom of, hey, could I come to a visit too? Could we have this conversation together? And depending on what your mom wants, that could be helpful.
And then finally, maybe there's some non-medication related ways of lowering your blood pressure. And we've talked about a bunch of them recently, including even
Lowering salt or hibiscus tea.
Hibiscus tea.
Right.
So let's not forget some non-medication ways to do this. Julie, what's our very next house call?
I am 65 years old and I love to exercise. I just took up exercise in the last 5 years or so. I go to the gym 4 days a week where I do water aerobics and work with a trainer. On the other days, I take long walks with my friends and do strength exercises. I feel great. My cholesterol blood work has improved and my blood pressure is better. However, my daughter recently told me that I'm overdoing it. How much is too much?
Good for you. That's what I have to say. Good for you. That's a great story.
Yeah, I might tell your daughter that you're doing great.
Maybe she needs to be doing more.
Yeah, there sounds like there may be some guilt going on here, Christy. I don't know here, but, you know, yeah, it doesn't sound like you're overdoing it to me.
It doesn't sound like you're ever doing it to me either. And the fact that you feel great and your cholesterol is better, your blood pressure is better, I mean, all that speaks to what, you know, we're talking to patients about every day, that, you know, exercise is so very good for you. And if you feel good, I say keep going.
Yeah, you know, the only thing here that I guess, you know, what would be too much? Well, too much would be if you're perhaps extending your heart rate beyond the maximum that you could for your age on a consistent basis, and so you were getting so fatigued after exercise, but that's not happening to you.
Or if you were losing so much weight that it was unhealthy in some way, you weren't eating properly.
Yeah, but you know, the only question here really is what's going on with your daughter, and why is she concerned? Has this exercise routine altered your dynamics in your relationship, where you might have sat around before and watched TV, and now you're up doing things, and she's feeling a little bit of a loss here. So I would actually take her out to lunch, take her for a walk, actually, probably, and meet her on her terms and let her know that your doctors, hopefully, actually, you can ask your doctor, but I suspect they're going to say what Christy and I say, it's fine. But find out really why, what's going on here. Maybe she's worried about losing you, and somehow this is part of what's going on.
That's good advice, Adam. Julie, what do we have next?
My dear friend has been declining for a few years now. She was doing odd things and becoming forgetful. It seemed like she was really depressed, which was understandable because her husband passed away many years ago, and she has been lonely. But it seems like she also might have dementia, and now her daughter took her to the doctor, and she has a diagnosis of Lewy body disease. Internet searches make that look pretty awful. Can you explain what that is?
Well, I'm sorry about your friend. It's really hard to watch someone you care about decline in that way and have troubles. But it's good that she has, it sounds like her daughter is involved and that she has support from both you and her family.
Yeah, and it is kind of scary. And dementia is not a good thing, really, under almost any circumstance here. And the fact that she's been declining for a few years, unfortunately, means that this process is probably more advanced and the ability to intervene now is less.
So Lewy body disease is a term that it's related to two diagnoses that are similar, both Parkinson's disease dementia and dementia with these things called Lewy bodies. And the symptoms can be similar to both Parkinson's disease and to Alzheimer's dementia.
Yeah, and the people who have Lewy's body disease may react negatively to some of the medications used to treat Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, as well as some of the over-the-counter medications. And so it's more difficult to treat, and you're going to need really a comprehensive treatment plan with your primary care provider and possibly even a specialist.
And the treatment is usually targeted towards improving symptoms of memory or movement problems or potentially hallucinations or problems with sleep. But there are strategies that with using multiple members of the care team that can improve those symptoms and make a difference for people. Unfortunately, there's not a treatment that just cures the disease, which is, is hard.
The best thing you'll be doing right now is being a friend and a social support for what will be a very difficult period, possibly for the next few months to years. So thank you for sharing that experience with us. But that's going to conclude, I think, Christy, what we can talk about on House Calls today. We've had a chance to talk about dementia and different types, including Lewy body disease.
We're going to talk about osteoarthritis in the knees and prevention.
What to be concerned about, even if your blood pressure doesn't seem too high but can still be lowered.
And about loving exercise and potentially having tensions in the family over how much you love to exercise.
Well, thank you for joining us today for Here's to Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues that are important to you, and you can send us your own questions at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can also follow us on Twitter by searching for Here's to Your Health.
And we'd like to thank the staff of WCHL and the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our producer Julie Steiner, and our guest today, Dr. John Dittmer. We hope you'll join us next time on Here's to Your Health.
On behalf of UNC Department of Family Medicine, I'm Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Here's to Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website at 1360WCHL.com and click on WCHL On Demand. Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine at News Talk 1360 WCHL.